good morning. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader. Thank you very much for joining me. Coming up this evening, House of Darkness, House of Light, the inside story from the hit scary thriller movie, The Conjuring, from last year. Andrea Perrin joins us. But first, let's get an update on a good friend of Coast to Coast AM. UFOlogist Stanton Friedman suffered a heart attack last week, and joining us now from the Roswell UFO Festival out in Roswell, New Mexico, from Paranormal Pop Culture, we have Aaron Sagers joining us. Good evening, Aaron.
Hello, Dave. Thanks for having me on tonight.
Yeah, thank you very much. Now, I know you were out there. This is only the second of the Roswell conferences that Stanton has not been able to attend. Unfortunately, it's also following up on the heels of the loss of Jesse Marcel Jr. last year after his final appearance at Roswell UFO Festival. What's the atmosphere there like with these two heavyweights kind of being out of the mix?
Well, the loss of Jesse is certainly felt amongst the speakers, including myself here at the Roswell Festival, and everybody is disappointed that Stan could not make it. However, on a panel that I was hosting along with Don Schmidt and Tom Carey and Frank Kimbler, we were able to get Stan on the phone, so we got an update directly from him.
All right, great. Now, for people, again, that don't know, Stanton Friedman is one of the people that helped blow the lid off of the Roswell UFO crash. He brought it back to light. I think it was late 70s, early 80s, and really kind of made it what it is today. He suffered a heart attack. Was it last Saturday, I believe?
It was a week ago Friday.
Okay. Suffered a heart attack. He's been in the hospital. Is he home yet, or is he still in hospital recuperating?
As of today, he is back home, Dave, after spending about a week in the hospital. And, you know, he was in very good spirits, and he mentioned that he had to have some stents put in, but there was no major surgery that was required. And, you know, in classic Stan style, he was saying that he was just bored in the hospital room, and, you know, he's in good spirits. And there was no major restrictions put on him as far as travel or activities, and he even joked that it maybe had something to do with him joining a gym just a couple months back, but you know, of course, that's probably not the case.
Right. All right, Aaron, thank you very much for joining us and giving us the update on Stanton Friedman. If you'd like more information on anything and everything, paranormalpopculture.com is the website to check out. Aaron Sagers is a widely read and published newspaper columnist. He works with CNN and many other outlets, but you can find all of the best in paranormal pop culture right at his website, paranormalpopculture.com. When we come back, we will be joined by Andrea Perrin. If you recognize that name, it's because you saw one of the creepiest scary thrillers to come out, in my opinion, in the last 15 to 20 years. If I had to shortlist it, I would say the movie Sinister, the brand new movie Deliver Us from Evil about Ralph Sarchi, but The Conjuring leading the way in what I feel is truly a great throwback to old-time psychological thriller horror movies. No slash and gash and gore fest. It's an actual, honest-to-goodness, really creepy movie. But did you know that it's based and inspired by real events? The Perrin family. We're going to talk to Andrea about her books and the reality behind the movie The Conjuring right after this. Good evening. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader. Tonight, we've got a great show lined up for you. I will tell you that in the last 15 to 20 years, I've been severely disappointed by the horror movie genre. As I said in the last segment, just gore fests and really getting away and straying away from storylines. Last year, a movie came out called The Conjuring, inspired by real events. This movie freaked me out. It was so well acted, so well written and directed. It was a great throwback psychological thriller. But the story that it comes from is based in reality. Tonight, we're going to talk with one of the survivors from that haunting, Andrea Perrin. She'll share her real-life story with us. She'll talk about some of the controversy that's erupted since the movie came out, and we'll find out what's up with the haunting and the Perrin family now. Welcome to Coast AM, Andrea Perrin. Good evening, Andrea.
Oh, good evening, Dave. Thank you so much for inviting me. This is just lovely.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here with us. And, I'll tell you what, I've met a lot of people over the years involved in the paranormal, and many people that have sold their stories to Hollywood, and so many people are very pretentious and, oh, look at me, I'm this. And you have got to be one of the sweetest women I've ever come across. You are just so down to earth and sweet and kind to everybody that's come up to you seeking advice, help, insights on their own hauntings. So I just wanted to make a public acknowledgement to you for the work that you do in answering other people's questions that feel they're being overwhelmed by a haunting. And I just want to thank you for the work that you're continuing to do with so many people out there.
Oh, I appreciate that. You know, I'll tell you the truth, Dave. I'm the same way with everyone all the time. It would take so much extra work that I do not have time to invest to perfect an alternate persona for the world. I'm just not up for it. I'm too old for this. Well, you know, I go to these events and have the opportunity to meet wonderful people like yourself. You know, I had done your show prior to meeting you, and it was delightful. That's why I go. That's why I put myself out there into the world. And I've only done a handful of paracons. I tell my mom, it only took 5 years to become an overnight sensation. It's amazing, amazing to me.
Now, you've started to document your personal story, your family's story, in a series of books, House of Darkness, House of Light. And people can find your website by going to houseofdarknesshouseoflight.com to find out more. Were you and your family surprised by just how popular the movie became?
I wasn't. And I'll tell you, at first, I was absolutely mortified when one of the producers, my friend Rob Cohen, called me and told me that James Wan was chosen as the director and would be at the helm of this. I about cried. I was sitting at my desk. I said, Rob, please don't tell me this. You just hired the king of slasher porn to make my family's intimate story. Are you kidding me? He said, no, you don't understand. It's going to be fine. Well, for months, the angst, I can't tell you, because I didn't know him. And all I knew was his reputation. I had never even seen any of his films. The first horror film I've ever seen in my life was The Conjuring. I mean, you know, being from the school of been there and done that, what's the point of going to a theater to be scared? I can just go home from school. You know, it was just a turn when I signed that contract and said, here, to their use of our names and likenesses. I was putting everything on the line. That was the biggest leap of faith that I took around this entire project, because they could have done anything with this film, and it said so in the contract. So, and then, of course, James comes on, and I was totally freaked out. But then they invited us out to the set, and we met everyone that had anything to do, the entire cast and crew, all the producers, everyone was there. And all of the angst just washed away, because I knew that not only was James handling the little girls very sensitively in terms of their portrayals and what they needed to do to make this film, but that was the most important thing to us, because, of course, you know, we didn't want five little kids to be traumatized in any way like we were when we were five little kids. And they were such lovely actresses, all of them, just as sweet as they could be. The entire, you could feel the love on the set. I know that sounds corny, but you could. And I knew then, after speaking at length with James and the group of producers, the set designer, everybody that was involved with this, that it was being treated with great sensitivity, that it was being a well-crafted film. And I think that the finished product speaks for itself. And I think that the work that he did, that James did in this film, catapults him into the upper echelon of genre directors in the world. I thought it was an extremely well-made film. Unfortunately, there's a lot of fiction in it, and I have spent the last year telling people, you know, there are some major discrepancies between the true story and the film. And so, you know, feel free. And I know you know a lot about this. So feel free to ask me anything. There are no questions off the table about this, and Warner Brothers and New Line Cinema have given me free rein to discuss the discrepancies, to, you know, really put it out there, because people should know the truth.
Well, and the interesting thing is, it says straight up in the title, inspired by true events. And people that go to see Hollywood movies have to realize that that means the idea of a family in a haunted house is the only nugget they need to then just create whatever Hollywood story comes out of it. Was your family pleased with the overall results of the movie, even though it didn't really adhere to your exact storyline?
Well, my mother watched it for the first time about 3 weeks ago, and you probably saw my post on Facebook about
right.
that. And I had, I think, 600 responses to it. And when she first saw the initial trailer, she walked into the parlor. Rob Cohen, the producer, sent me the initial trailer just as the day that it was being released nationwide. And I had it in a little box on the screen, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, Christine, my sister, Christine, come here, look at this. And my mother walks in the parlor, and she walks up behind us, and she says, why don't you make that big screen? I turned around. I said, you don't even know how to turn a computer on. Where did you come up with that? She's like, just make it big. And she crosses her arms and she stands there. And, you know, the initial trailer was when Lily Taylor had that oddly geometric orange and brown skirt on.
Right.
And the girls all come piling into the house, which was actually quite like how we were. We traveled en masse. And when it was done, when the trailer was over, she just shook her head and she said, I would not have been caught dead in that skirt. And then walked out of the room, just walked away. I said, well, all right, okay. And then, of course, there were subsequent trailers, and she wanted to look at those, but she didn't really want to watch the film. And the reason was because we all, the rest of us, went out to the premiere in Hollywood, and we came back and we discussed with her some of the major discrepancies. For instance, there was no exorcism in our house, ever. You know, that's kind of a big point when it's the climax of the film, you know. But the thing she was most upset about, to be perfectly honest with you, is that she felt that the film represented our family more as godless heathens than as spiritual people. And nothing could have been further from the truth. We were all born and raised Catholic. My father grew up in the church as an altar boy, served as long as he could, and went to a Catholic school. And we were all baptized. We were confirmed into the church. We had a very strong affiliation with the Catholic Church. We did not turn our back on the church. The church turned their back on us because our priest was mortified when he heard what was happening in our house. And he very sweetly and politely asked my father one Easter Sunday, I believe. It was Easter. And asked my father if he would make sure that from then on our family would worship elsewhere. And that was the last time that we ever went to church as a family. I think
that is unbelievable.
15,
and we'll tackle.
I was 14.
We'll tackle part of that story as we continue, because I do want to get into some of the discrepancies. But you mentioned that there was no exorcism done in the home. Did your mother, in fact, deal with a possession? And we don't have to get too ingrained in it, but I'm just curious. Was there a form of possession that did happen to your mother in reality?
Something took over my mother. And I do want to speak to this later. And I know we've got all night, Dave.
Right.
So, you know, I will start here, and then we can pick up after the break. However,
do you think that that's why she was reticent to see this movie? You've got to guess that that's got to be a tough part of your life to relive, even if it's Hollywoodized. But to know that at one point in your life, you were out of control. And I don't mean that in a, you just made a lot of stupid choices and bad decisions out of control, but rather, you weren't in control of who you were or what was happening around you. Something else was running the ship. Do you think that might have been a little bit of why your mom was not as ready to jump in and see this movie?
I think that that's a very insightful question, and it deserves a proper response. I don't think that, and neither does my mother, by the way, think that any of us are in control of anything ever. That our perceptions of what we control in this life are greatly diminished by actual reality. And so I think that there was much more an issue with control around the spiritual entities in the house regarding my father than my mother. My mother was at once repulsed and fascinated by what was happening in that house, and she was under attack a number of times. Instead of there being an exorcism in the cellar of the home, there was a seance that occurred. And my
All right, well, let's get to that a little bit later. I don't want to jump too. I don't want to keep seesawing through the story. Let's get to all of the good stuff and the creepy stuff as we progress through this story here and get into it, because it is. You know, I've had a chance to meet you. I've met your father. It's so intriguing to meet you both and know that this story. I've read your books, and it's fascinating. It's chilling because of the reality that you share of what occurred in your lives. Maybe start us off with this, Andrea, for people that are not familiar with your story. We just have a few minutes left in this segment. Give us a breakdown. Around what year did you and your family move into this new home?
Okay. My mother found the house in June of 1970. We moved in on January 11th, 1971, even though they had closed on the house the prior year in December. And then we left in June of 1980. So from finding it to leaving it was a full 10 years, month to month, a full decade.
Was there any indication prior to you taking this home that there was anything strange?
No, actually, and that's something that I wrote about, and I wrote specifically about in Volume 3, which is forthcoming any day now, and that is that there was no indication. We made numerous visits to the farm from the day that we all went there as a family before we actually moved in. We spent a pretty considerable amount of time there with dear old Mr. Kenyon, who was the owner who was selling the property to my parents, and became fast friends with him. And he gave us the run of the place. We had been in the barn. We had been in the woodshed. We'd been all through the house, all around the property, all of us, my parents included. And none of us had any inkling, no sensation whatsoever that anything was happening. And, of course, none of us even went there with that expectation. I was only 11 years old, 12 when we moved in. And my youngest sister was 5. You know, none of us were thinking, oh, there are ghosts here. None of us even knew what that was. So, and my parents didn't think about it either. My father was like, how am I going to update this electrical system? And my mother's like, how can I go fishing at the pond? You know, it was, nobody was even thinking about supernatural activity. It wasn't on the radar. But the day we moved in, boom, as soon as we moved in, I'm talking within minutes of moving in that house. I was the first one to have an encounter. And then Nancy, Cindy, and Christine, 4 of the 5 children, saw an apparition standing in our dining room who had his leg up on the door. He had his arms crossed. He had a crooked little grin on his face. And he was fixated watching Mr. Kenyon pack the last of his belongings from the china cabinet in the dining room. He appeared as a full body, solid human being to me, to the extent that I thought oddly dressed, perhaps, but I greeted him as I walked by with a box in my arms. And then Christine came in the kitchen and said, who's that other man with Mr. Kenyon? My mother said, there is no other man. And then Cindy came in and she said, Mom, who's that other man with Mr. Kenyon? And my mother said, there's no other man. And then Nancy came in and said, that man in the dining room with Mr. Kenyon just disappeared. Well, it was chaos in the house. It was a caravan and a moving truck and boxes and kids and people everywhere. And it got dismissed until it got discussed later. And that's when we realized that 4 of the 5 of us had seen him. And that at one point, my father was standing in the dining room talking to Mr. Kenyon with that apparition standing right at the corner, not 3 feet away from him. And my father didn't see him, but we all did.
So the girls saw him, but your father seemed immune, and Mr. Kenyon didn't seem to notice this specter.
Mr. Kenyon did not seem to notice him, and my father was technically oblivious, yes.
Wow, that is so strange when you look at this story and you realize all the people involved in it. And why would some people, especially with something that strong, not just a flicker out of the corner of your eye, a possible scratching or knock that could have been an outside source or a mouse skittering through the walls, but a group of you seeing a full-on three-dimensional figure in a room by two other grown men that nobody is taking notice of. Mm-hmm. I mean, did that make you and your sister start to question your own sanity? We'll find out the answer to that question and more when we return with Andrea Perrin from The Real Life Conjuring, House of Darkness, House of Light on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I am Dave Schrader. If you like the strange and the supernatural, you can join me Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. till midnight, as we explore the supernatural, monsters, myths, and legends, and more on Darkness Radio. Check out darknessradio.com. You can stream it live direct from our website. And then stay right there, because as soon as our show is over, George Norrie and Coast to Coast continues your journey into the strange and bizarre. This evening, The Conjuring, House of Darkness, House of Light. Survivor Andrea Perrin is here to tell us the truth behind the hit movie from last year, The Conjuring. We were talking with her in the last segment about their first encounter in the home. What was the effect of seeing a spirit in the house that no one else was noticing? Did they start to question their own sanity? Did they start to question their own safety? We'll find out the answer to that and so much more right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host for the evening, Dave Schrader. My guest this evening is Andrea Perrin. Andrea is one of the children that grew up in the home that was featured in the movie The Conjuring. Her real-life story is told over a trilogy of books, the third book due out any day now, House of Darkness, House of Light. Check out the website, houseofdarknesshouseoflight.com, for more information on our guest, for more information on her books, and to delve deeper into the story behind last year's hit horror movie, The Conjuring. Andrea, when you and your sisters are seeing a full apparition that nobody else is witnessing, how do you start to process something like that? I mean, this hasn't happened in your family before. It wasn't like the Perrin family was a band of wandering psychics and mediums that could see things everywhere they went, the Ghost Whisper family. What was it like to have this awakening there?
Well, we moved in as a perfectly normal family, and we left a decade later as a supremely paranormal family. And I don't know if it was due to exposure, overexposure, or just innate gifts that we brought into the equation. And, of course, five little girls, and three of them on the verge of adolescence. We grew up, the five of us grew up in that house. Just that amount of energy, that amount of estrogen, that amount of everything that was going on is enough to stir things up anyway. But really, we weren't the target so much as my mother was the target. I will tell you that I didn't realize that I had seen a ghost the first day. He appeared perfectly solid to me. I greeted him. I said good morning to him on my way past, and he didn't respond to me. It was Nancy who saw him literally evaporate into thin air. The rest of us had seen him as a full body solid apparition, which means that he had mustered an enormous amount of energy to appear that way. And when the energy apparently dissipated is when Nancy passed through the dining room and saw him. And then he came back, which is fascinating in its own right. And we can delve into that later if you'd like.
Was he acknowledging you and your family, though, as though he knew you could see him?
No, not at all. He looked right through us like we were the ghosts, like we just didn't even exist. His focus, all of his energy and attention was focused primarily, exclusively on Mr. Kenyon, who was standing at the dining room table, his dining room table, which had to be removed before ours could come in. So there was kind of like a hustling going on there in terms of getting the last of his belongings packed. That poor dear man did not want to leave that house. He was forced to leave that house by his son because he knew it wasn't safe for him to be in such a remote location so far away. And he built a beautiful smaller home for his father right on his property right next to his house so that he could take care of him better. And but, you know, Mr. Kenyon didn't want to leave that house, but he did know something was going on there. He did, because before he left that day, he asked my father, in the midst of a swirling ice storm, is how we moved into that farm on January 11th, in the middle of a storm. And he took my father outside, asked him to go for a walk. And when they went out in the midst of this, he leaned over and he put his hand on my father's forearm, and he said, "Roger, for the sake of your family, leave the lights on at night." And that didn't make any sense to my father at the time. All that meant to him was new house, big family, one bathroom on the first floor, the girls are on the second floor, so nobody tumbles down the stairs, leave the house, this vacuumous, huge farmhouse, leave some lights on in the house. It made perfect sense to him for what it seemed to be. But it wasn't until later that we learned from people in the area, in the neighborhood, that for all the decades, the many decades that the Kenyons lived in that house, there was never a night ever, no matter what time you drove past that piece of property, that house wasn't lit up like a Christmas tree. Every single light was left on in that house every single night.
It seems, I mean, that's a strange thing to mention. But again, when there's no mention of supernatural or paranormal occurrences, your mind wouldn't normally go to that. So it would seem, oh, yeah, it's big, it's dark, it's new, keep the lights on so nobody's falling and getting hurt. That makes complete and utter sense to me. But in a way, it still has kind of a chilling connotation to it as you stand back in 2020 hindsight, right? And you hear this, everybody else out there in listener land would have been like, oh, I would have asked a question. I think people forget to remove themselves from the fact that they already know the ending of the story.
Right.
And put yourself into this at the beginning. And we'll get into the fact of once things start to amp up, I know the big question everybody will want to know, and we'll get to it in a little bit, of why would a family stay in a house this active with little children? But let's keep going and find out a little bit more about how the activity began to amp up. Now, it's strange that you say that it wasn't really focused towards you. It was focused towards your mom.
Mm-hmm.
But yet you and your sisters were the first to see and experience things there.
But the spirit that we saw was entirely benign. And in fact, over the course of that decade, my sister Nancy named him Manny. And she named him that because he was a man and she wasn't very creative at 9 years old. And so, because we didn't know who he was, but he was around so much that he became virtually a peripheral member of the family. And he would watch over us. And there was a benevolence about him that was totally disarming. There was no sense of being frightened by this spirit. There were many, many other things going on in the house that were truly frightening. And so he seemed the least of our worries. But within the first night or two that we were in the house, my little sister Cindy came crawling into bed with me. And I pulled the quilt back, of course. I had the big double bed, and I let her right in. And she said, "Annie, I'm scared. I'm scared. I hear voices in my room." Of course, I asked her what she heard. And she said, "There's a whole bunch of them. They're all standing around my bed, and they're all talking at once, but they're all saying the same thing." And I asked her what that was, and she said, "There are seven dead soldiers buried in the wall. There are seven dead soldiers buried in the wall," over and over and over. So if you think Mr. Kenyon's comment to my father was cryptic, this was much more so for a little 8-year-old who was scared witless. She didn't know what to think. She had not even encountered any of the children spirits in her room yet. We had just gotten there.
Andrea, your little sister just climbed into bed with you. So it's dark, it's nighttime, and you get, first of all, there's nothing creepier than a little kid that comes into your room and tells you something scary is going on. I'm a father of seven, and every time my kids have come to me with something like that, it's the most unnerving sensation. But here you're a kid at the same point. How are you feeling? I mean, first of all, it's kind of like, okay, all right, sure, you're hearing something in your room. What are they saying? And then she says something chilling like that. What does that feel like?
I remember specifically the first time that it happened. that I wrapped her up in my arms and pulled her up close to me, and I told her that it would be all right and that she could sleep with me. And then I heard the horn. And I had been hearing this very strange, almost bugle-like horn in my room that she could not hear in her room. And it started. It started to play. And at first I thought it was the wind in the eaves. I didn't know what to think about it. It wasn't until like 30 years later that I identified specifically the sound that I had heard as a child. And I heard it at a Revolutionary War reenactment in Lincoln, Rhode Island. And I stopped. I slammed the brakes on and pulled off the highway and listened. And I was like, oh, my God, that's what I heard. It was the clarion call to arms. That's what I heard in my room. And that first night, I pulled Cindy up close to me, and I said, do you hear it? Do you hear the what are you hearing? And we were trying to identify what it was. But in that area, you know, keep in mind, this house was, the property for it was deeded in 1680 as one of the original Providence plantations. The house as it exists now was completed in 1736, and it had been built onto built for decades into this massive farmhouse. And you know, so it had quite a history. It was there 40 years before the Revolutionary War, through the Dorr Rebellion and all of the skirmishes, the border skirmishes between the colonies, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, fighting for their little piece of turf, plus then the Civil War and everything else that came. Is it conceivable that seven soldiers crawled up into those walls and died there? Yes, it's conceivable. We didn't go looking for them.
You have no idea what this bugle horn sound is as a kid, but now you're being told that there's seven dead soldiers in the wall, seven dead soldiers, and your little sister's repeating that. Now, was there a different experience in every one of the rooms? Your sister seeing and hearing voices and people, you're hearing the horn. Was there always one type of haunting in each room?
No, there was a lot of crossover. And in fact, the spirits that were bothering Cindy in the middle bedroom, when I went off to college in 1976, she took my bedroom, and it got worse. But she saw things happen to me in my room that were so disturbing that she didn't even tell me about them until several years ago. And there are stories that are included in Volume 2 and Volume 3 about things that she witnessed happen to me in my room that were so horrifying to her that she hadn't told anybody, not even her husband.
And you don't
divulge them.
You didn't know that this was going on, but she saw these things happen to you?
Yes, she saw me being attacked one night by a large black opaque mass that was, as she described it, like a thick, dense smoke that was very fluid. And I always sleep always on my left side, always, and have my entire life. And she said that I was laying on my back, and this thing was hovering over me, and it was as if it was breathing for me. She did not see me or have any indication that I was breathing, and that this was hovering over me. And when it noticed her notice it, instead, it swept off of the top of my body. I was laying flat on my back. That never happens. And that was the thing that startled her most at first, was that I was laying flat on my back. But when it noticed her, notice it, it came sweeping, she said, like almost like a hurricane came sweeping down off of her and off of me and grabbed a hold of her two bottom feet. She was sleeping on my floor in a sleeping bag. And it grabbed a hold of her two bottom feet and started dragging her backwards down my stairwell. And the only thing that kept her from going all the way down to the bottom of the stairs was that she had the presence of mind at 14, is how old she was at that time, to wrap her arm around the post at the top of the stairs and hung on for dear life and screamed and screamed and screamed until she didn't have a voice left. In the morning, she had no voice left, and she came downstairs and got so frightened, bless her heart, that she wet herself. It was a horrible experience for her.
But none of you heard her screaming?
No, and there were people all around her. I was no more than 4 feet away from her, the middle bedroom. We had a sleepover that night, which is why we had friends. We had three friends over. our attorney, Sam Olofsson, came with all of his kids, and everybody was in sleeping bags, and it got too stuffy in there. So she came into my room, and that's when she saw me under attack. I have absolutely no memory of it, Dave, none whatsoever.
Could it be, Andrea, and again, bear with me for playing devil's advocate, but we have an intelligent audience that I know wants to know these questions too, and they make a reference in the movie to one of your sisters sleepwalking. Could it have been a sleepwalking incident where she was doing nothing more than lucid dreaming in a sleepwalk state, seeing these things occur, and only thought she screamed all night, you know, for that to go on? Because how could someone scream in a house full of people and no one hear it?
It happened all the time, David. That's one of the reasons why we didn't tell our story for 30 years. There are elements of the story that are quite literally unbelievable, that require a leap of faith from any reader to absorb what happened to us. Cindy calls that being in the bubble. I have no question in my mind that Cindy was awake, she was lucid, she saw what she saw, she was attacked the way that she was. It wasn't the first time, nor would it be the last, that this happened, something like this happened to her.
Cindy was there ever was any almost- physical? Was there ever any physical evidence, trace evidence left over, fingerprints, scratches, you know, anything like that that would show that she had been grabbed or pulled?
Yes. Yeah, she was covered in bruises. Her legs, her ankles were covered in bruises the next morning. She had been pulled halfway down the stairs. So she had some abrasions, some scrapes, but she stayed downstairs. She went downstairs thinking that I was dead and not knowing how to go wake my mother up and tell her to come upstairs. It was a terrible night. It was one of the worst experiences that Cindy ever had in the house, and that's really saying something, because Cindy, aside from my mother, Cindy's probably the one that had the most visitations in the house. And I think that has something to do with the fact that when she was an infant, she underwent a radical surgery within her first 2 months of life, and virtually died on the table and was brought back, and she came back to us. If she didn't come that way originally, she came back to us a very old soul. And she, I think, truly, and Cindy believes, she's been to the other side, and she's come back. So there was an attachment formed with a number of the spirits with her in the house, and some of them were very pleasant, and some of them were exceedingly unpleasant. And the spirit that came after my mother, the one who perceived herself to be the mistress of the house and felt a dramatic threat from my mother's presence there, likewise approached Cindy and Christine, and in both cases said, come with me, little girl, come to me, come with me. And when that happens, you can scream as loudly as you want. You can, and yes, there are times, there are incidents in the house that occurred where people said, you know, whether it was my mother or Christine or Nancy, I was screaming at the top of my lungs, and nothing was coming out of my mouth. I could hear the screaming in my head, in my mind, in my brain, in my forehead. I could hear it all, and not a sound was coming out of my mouth. And that happened with my mother. That happened the night that the entity that was after her first propositioned her, as it were, by standing literally over the side of her bed. There's a chapter in volume one called Kiss of Death, and my mother felt that this being, this apparition that was hanging over her was coming in almost to kiss her. She was so close to her face, and the smell was so overpowering that it caused my mother to retch in bed. It was, she was absolutely horrified. And yes, in terms of residual after effects, my father woke up the next morning with his back serrated as though a meat cleaver had been taken to him. He was a bloody mess. And the first thing he did was turn around and blame my mother. And all she was trying to do, she did try to wake him, but she did not tear his back to shreds. She's not the one that did that. She took her hand and she plunged it into his thick black hair, and she twisted it into a knot and pulled his head side to side and literally came out with her hand filled with hair. She did everything that she could to wake him up, and she was quite certain that he was dead and she was next. and that was the first encounter.
Well, anybody that was thinking about falling asleep during this interview just got woken up, I think, Andrea. That's unbelievable to it's have that kind of activity. When your family has this, and you, how long into the house had that actually occurred for your mother?
5 months.
Five
and you know what? That's a legitimate question that you asked before, and I appreciate you asking it because it gives me an opportunity to answer it. I hear it a lot. What the hell is wrong with you people that you stayed there for 10 years?
Let's answer that when we come back. Our guest, Andrea Perrin, House of Darkness, House of Light, the real story behind the movie The Conjuring on Coast to Coast AM.